Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Kate, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's workshop, Coping with the Stress of Caregiving When Your Loved One Has Myeloid Fibrosis. And this is a two-part series, and it's part of a series on living with myeloid fibrosis, and indeed, this is our part two. And the focus of today's program is really for caregivers. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have over 552 participants on the call today, and you come from all of the United States, all different parts of the United States, as well as we have international participants from Australia, Canada, India, the Netherlands, the Philippines, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world. And it's really a credit to each of you that you're spending the next hour with us. Today's program was made possible by a grant from Insight Corporation, and I really want to thank them for their support of our program today and for this entire series. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to all of the materials that you received from Cancer Care. You either got the materials by email as a packet, email packet, or as a paper packet. In those materials is information about our speakers and about all of our different collaborating organizations as a resource, additional resources for all of you. There are some wonderful resources in there, and they're all free for you to contact. There also is an evaluation form, and I'm going to ask you all at the end of today's program to complete that evaluation form. You are our best, really, consultants in terms of what the programs should look like going forward. The topics you'd like us to offer, we very much rely upon your recommendations. Indeed, this series is one that you've recommended that we do, and so we're offering it. And we're planning many programs going forward, and your input really helps us to keep the programs most relevant to meet your particular needs. So tell us what you want, and we'll try very hard to provide that for you. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Brady Stein, and Dr. Stein is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, Division of Hematology Oncology, Department of Medicine. And Dr. Stein is going to provide an overview of myelofibrosis. He's going to discuss some current treatments and the importance of caring for your loved one with myelofibrosis. It's my pleasure now to introduce Dr. Stein.
So thank you very much, Dr. Messner, for the introduction and for the opportunity to participate in this teleconference. I'd like to thank all of you for participating as well. And so as Dr. Messner stated, it's my task to provide you with an overview of myelofibrosis. So this is something many of you may know about, but hopefully I can shed some general light here. So what is myelofibrosis? That's the first point I want to cover. So this is, as you may know, it's a bone marrow stem cell or parent cell disease, and it's got a couple of hallmark features, and these hallmark features are the presence of what we call systemic or whole body symptoms. Some of these are driven by high levels of inflammation in the blood. Many symptoms come from organ enlargement, particularly that of the spleen, which is located on the left side under the rib cage. Another characteristic of myelofibrosis is variation in the blood counts. And so some blood counts can be too high, particularly the white cell count or the platelet count. Other blood counts can be too low, particularly the red blood cells, and that can lead to anemia. And perhaps the most prominent feature of myelofibrosis is the bone marrow scarring, and this is where the myelofibrosis gets its name. So as you know, myelofibrosis can be primary, so that means it can arise on its own out of the blue, or for some patients, myelofibrosis can be secondary. So that means that it can evolve out of a prior blood disorder, perhaps a long-standing history of essential thrombocythemia when the platelets are too high, or polycythemia vera when the red cell count is too high. So when you talk with family and friends about the diagnosis of myelofibrosis, it's often very challenging because many family or friends, and perhaps primary care providers, have not heard of this disease or know little about it. And that's because it's relatively rare based on our latest estimates is approximately 13,000 cases in the United States. This could be an underestimate, but it's the latest research we have. And some other typical features of myelofibrosis as we look at epidemiology or demographics, we know that for unclear reasons, there's a slight male predominance in myelofibrosis. We know that most patients are in their 60s when they're diagnosed, and this is relevant because they may have other chronic medical conditions at this point along with myelofibrosis. And this is really important for both patient and caretaker alike to make sure they don't neglect these other medical conditions that are occurring alongside myelofibrosis. When myelofibrosis happens, in most cases, it appears somewhat out of the blue. And what I mean by that is that often patients have no risk factors for developing this. So it's not anything a patient did do or did not do to bring this on. So in most cases, we can't find out why this happened. It's more rare that we'll meet patients who have developed myelofibrosis after perhaps an exposure to radiation, a chemical such as benzene. That is the more rare scenario. In most cases, it happens on its own out of the blue. And so how do we come to a diagnosis of myelofibrosis? And I'll just go over this fairly briefly, but the point I'd like to make is that this requires a conversation and a collaboration between both the healthcare provider and the pathologist. So some of the criteria that we see that needs to be met to make this diagnosis will include the presence of anemia, a low red blood cell count for some patients, the presence of a large spleen, that's often a presenting feature, abnormalities under the microscope as we look at mature blood cells, and of course, abnormalities of the bone marrow as we review under the microscope, and the most prominent feature is scarring. Together with the pathologist, the clinician needs to rule out another blood disease that could mimic myelofibrosis. So there can be other diseases that lead to similar patterns in terms of blood counts. Other diseases can lead to splenic enlargement. Other diseases can scar the bone marrow. So we have to think carefully to make sure those diseases are not present. And of course, we can use some sophisticated tests to make a diagnosis of myelofibrosis. And so some of you may know the status of the JAK2 mutation. So many of you have been tested, and you may find that you're positive or negative. That's about 50% of cases of myelofibrosis which possess a JAK2 mutation in the blood. So the next step after the healthcare provider makes a diagnosis is to assess the prognosis. And really, this may tell us where a patient exists in the spectrum of myelofibrosis because it's very heterogeneous. And it may tell us what the right treatment could be. Of course, this is an individualized care plan when we make treatment decisions. But as your doctor makes this diagnosis, he or she is looking at a number of features, what kind of symptoms you have, particularly what we call constitutional symptoms, symptoms like fevers, drenching sweats, or weight loss. Of course, they're looking at your age when you're diagnosed, and they're looking at patterns. Low red cells and a requirement for blood cell transfusion, low platelets, increased white cells, and whether these white cells that are in the blood are very immature, you may have heard the term blast. And then, of course, we're looking at some more sophisticated tests like an analysis of the chromosomes, the karyotype you may have heard, or cytogenetics. This is all of the things that the doctor in the office can use to help assess where you exist on the spectrum of myelofibrosis. In some cases, it's a tally of these points or risk factors that a doctor might use to make treatment decisions. So a doctor may decide to refer a patient for an official stem cell transplantation consult. In some cases, that is a decision made based on an analysis of those risk factors that we discussed. But more commonly, when we make treatment decisions, we're looking at symptoms. So in most cases, either because of age or other existing medical problems or other factors like availability of a donor, a stem cell transplant may not be an option. So we're very much focused on relieving symptoms. And so this is where the caregiver can play an important role. It's very important that if the patient is not necessarily expressing some of these symptoms to the doctor, that if they're present and the caregiver is aware, it might be important for the caregiver to speak up during the doctor's appointment, because we really need to see what symptoms are present. And some of these we wouldn't necessarily know about unless you told us. And some of these symptoms that can demand treatment can include whole body or systemic symptoms. Fatigue is almost universal. Fevers, weight loss, night sweats, itching, pain in the bone or muscles. For some patients, the symptoms stem largely from anemia or a low red blood cell count, and that may be the focus. We may use specific agents to treat the anemia. For many other patients, it could be primarily the enlargement of the spleen that can lead to pain on the left side, getting full early, having to change the way you eat, your portion size in particular, having cough or weight loss. So that could be the most dominant symptom for the patient that demands attention or treatment. So it's really important to express the symptoms, both patient and caregiver alike, to the physician or healthcare provider during these appointments, because we can tailor our therapy appropriately based on the pattern of symptoms. So what I'd conclude with is a couple tips on living well with myelofibrosis. And myelofibrosis really requires a team. The first point I'd like to make is this is a somewhat rare disease, and it can feel isolating because when you're in your doctor's office, you may be the only patient in the waiting room. You may be the only patient in your doctor's practice that has myelofibrosis. So it can feel isolating, but try not to isolate yourself. Involve family, friends, and caregivers, and seek support groups. So if you're participating in a conference like this, I think this is a wonderful step. But support groups can happen online. They can happen in person. And through the Myeloproliferative Neoplasm Research Foundation, there's often a representative, perhaps in your state, in the United States at least, who can help direct you to a local support group so you can seek company of others to discuss. The point I made earlier about not neglecting other medical conditions that might be present, it's important to keep yourself as strong and fit and other chronic medical conditions under as good as control as possible. This is very, very important. Don't forget about those. It may be certainly life-changing when the diagnosis is made, but keep close attention on those factors. And in the same way, keep a healthy diet and try to exercise. I know this can be very, very difficult, especially in patients who are fatigued, but one of the best treatments of fatigue is to start a light exercise program. And then as I conclude, the point I would like to make as well is I think it's very helpful to establish a myelofibrosis team. So that part of that team is your family, friends, and caregivers. Of course, your local doctor who can handle the routine visits and blood counts and blood transfusions as they're needed. But I think it's also important to seek the care of a myelofibrosis expert, someone who is studying myelofibrosis on a daily basis, who's aware of the scientific breakthroughs, and who might have access to clinical trials and hopefully can also act as a valuable team member to troubleshoot if there needs to be a change in the strategy. So I'd like to conclude with that. I thank you very much for your attention, and hopefully we'll have some time during that question and answer session to go over any of your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stein. That was really an excellent presentation, a wonderful overview for everybody, and very important tips for everybody as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Laurel Northouse, Mary Lou Willard, French Professor of Nursing, University of Michigan School of Nursing. And Dr. Northouse is going to address what research tells us about caregiving, managing family, friends, partners, and traditions, self-care, and stress management tips. And it's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Northouse.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's very nice to be on this call today. And as you mentioned, I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about what we've learned from research about caregivers. Well, first of all, we know from some of the national surveys that most of the caregivers in the United States are family members or close friends of the person who is ill. Very few people get home care services, and so really a number of people have called these family caregivers the long-term care providers in the United States, so they serve a very important role. And one of the stresses we see in caregivers today is that patients are often leaving the hospital or going home when they certainly need a lot of care or they are getting complex treatments, and so that really increases the role of the caregiver to try to help out as much as he or she can. We also know from the surveys that most caregivers are women. Now, the number of male caregivers is increasing, but still predominantly caregivers are women. Something else that came out of this large survey I'm talking about said that often caregivers feel like they don't have a choice to be a caregiver. All of a sudden, the person in the family will get sick, and somebody is sort of tapped as the person who's expected to be the caregiver. This can often be family or friends that are in the close geographical vicinity of the person who's ill. And oftentimes, it's the women who are often thought of as care providers, and so the adult daughters, sister, and so on, may be the one who is expected to step forward and be the caregiver. And even though it would be helpful if people had a choice, what we do find is if a person suddenly is tapped to be the caregiver unexpectedly or maybe not by first choice, that can create some stress as well. So we've learned that the stress of the patient's illness can affect the caregivers in many ways. It takes the greatest toll on the caregiver's psychological well-being, as you can imagine. We typically don't see the stress on the caregiver's physical well-being until longer down the course of illness, or if more care is needed, then over time the caregiver might get worn out and we may see more physical manifestations of stress in the caregiver. But let me talk for a minute about that psychological well-being that we often see, you know, that can change. Well, first of all, it's not uncommon for caregivers to feel anxious or worried or depressed as they watch their loved ones suffer. Some studies have even found that caregivers' heart rate and blood pressure can go up as they see suffering in their loved one. And in some situations, we actually find in the research that caregivers can report more emotional distress than the patient. That may surprise some of you. Others of you, that might not surprise. But we know that the caregivers are affected as well as the person with the illness, and that when we've given them the same measure of emotional distress, the caregivers often score as high as the patients. One other thing we've learned about emotional well-being in the research is that there is a reciprocal relationship between the emotional distress of the patient and the caregiver. And what I mean by reciprocal is that if one person is distressed, it's likely that the other person will be distressed. So each person affects the other sort of as a unit. And so neither person is immune from the stress of the situation, like the caregiver. They are closely involved in the well-being of the patient, and then they too often feel this distress. So we tend to see that caregivers become especially overwhelmed when the demands expected of them exceed the resources that they have. It can also be particularly stressful when caregivers are expected to provide care in the home, but they don't have the information that they need to provide the quality of care they want to provide. And as Dr. Stein said, that's when it's helpful when the caregivers come to the office as well, so they can learn about the symptoms and feel more confident in how to help the patient manage him. It's, I think these symptoms can be troubling, and for example, if you get symptoms like pain, family caregivers are wondering what's the best approach, when is there too much medication, when is there too little, so it's really important that caregivers get information to help reduce their uncertainty. Now, the findings from this one study I'm going to mention might surprise you out there. And it says that caregivers generally can do fairly well monitoring some of these physical tasks, but they often don't know how to deal with the emotional distress that they see in their loved ones, such as the fear, worry, or depression, and they're just not sure whether they should tell the person to, get with it, try not to dwell on it. They just often are unsure of how to be helpful to their loved one with the emotional issues. And so that's why I really think it's important you're on this call as well, or you use the services of Cancer Care and some of the other organizations, because you can learn ways to deal with some of these emotional concerns that you just may feel unsettled about. I also want to mention that not all caregivers have extremely high distress. The research says that about 30% of the caregivers report really high levels of distress. And those who have high distress, we tend to see these characteristics. The caregiver may have a lot of uncertainty. They don't know what to expect. Another stress factor is they lack confidence as caregivers. They don't feel confident in their role or how to carry it out. They may feel isolated from others in their family, or they may not be able to get out as much, so they feel like they're all alone trying to deal with the illness. That's another risk factor. Another one is that caring for a loved one who is seriously ill with a lot of problems that can be overwhelming. The research also says when a caregiver experiences a lot of strain in their role, if someone just asks you, how much strain are you experiencing? Is it just a little, a medium amount, or a lot of strain? Those caregivers who say they have a lot of strain tend to be the ones who are experiencing that high level of distress. And those are the caregivers that may need to talk with their healthcare provider about ways to get additional help to reduce the strain that they're experiencing. And one other stress factor I want to mention that can predict these families with high distress is when the caregiver, him or herself, is also ill. That, you know, as Dr. Stein said, many of the patients get this disease when they're in their 60s or so forth, and that's when we also see caregivers getting other chronic illnesses themselves. And so if the caregiver has two or three chronic illnesses, and that's actually what we found in one of our studies, that as the caregiver aged, they themselves had two or three conditions, well, then their own health may be a little bit more challenged, and therefore it's difficult to take on the role of caregiver to their loved one. But even though caregivers can feel stressed, and there are some of these families that have really high distress, I just want to say that there are also some positive effects to caregiving, and I'm sure many of you out there can tell us what those are. It's not all negative about stress. It's also there are positive things, and those positive things can kind of balance out the stress we see in caregivers. So some of the positive things that caregivers have told us is that when a loved one is ill, it can help pull the family closer together. They may rethink their priorities, like they may decide not to spend so much time at work, try to have more free time, try to do a vacation, even a short, small one, if they can. And another positive aspect is that sometimes the caregivers feel good about being able to help. They know they're doing something important, and so that's a positive part of caregiving. So let me talk just a little bit about managing family and friends and partners and some traditions. One of the challenges for the caregivers is it's really hard to keep everybody informed about what's going on with the well-being of the patient or the person with the illness. And it's not uncommon for caregivers to get overwhelmed with these questions. You know, how much did they say? When are they saying too much? When are they kind of hiding things? And so it's just difficult. So the extent to which the caregiver and the patient or their loved one with the illness can decide ahead of time how much information do they want to give others, or which are their really close people they are agree to give information to, and then try to work together to sort out who to give information to. But it's also common for people to say to the caregiver, how can I help you? And for caregivers to quickly say, oh, I'm fine, nothing's the matter, even though underneath they may feel quite overwhelmed. Some caregivers need to put on this strong front, this strong face, just so that people think that they can do this job. But when caregivers put on that strong front, others really don't know how to help them. I recently saw a picture of a lion, and the caption underneath the picture said, when you show a strong front like a lion, others don't know you're hurting inside. And so I think it's really important that if you are a caregiver that you try to use the help, even though you may be a very independent person not used to doing that, try to get help to deal with the situation you're in. The topic of traditions, I'll just briefly mention because one of our other speakers is going to talk a little bit more about it. But, you know, there's often traditions in the family. There's get-togethers. There's certain, you know, the annual picnic here or there, or there's the holidays. But some are sort of traditions. Some can even become kind of rigid that you just do because you've always done them. And when someone's feeling ill, it can be very hard to maintain some of those traditions. And it can also be hard for the caregiver. So as you think about traditions, you may try to see if there are ways you could simplify some of the traditions you've done. That doesn't mean you need to stop them, but just try to either simplify them or encourage others who are really wanting you to do these same traditions to encourage them to be a little bit more flexible as you're trying to recover from the illness. So let me just take a minute or two to talk about self-care and some stress management tips. First of all, it's very important for caregivers to maintain their own health so they don't get burned out and develop health problems of their own. As I mentioned, that caregivers often have as much distress. Over time, their physical problems can occur, and they really need to take care of themselves. Now, you may just say, oh, I've heard that all the time, and I'm doing that fine. But I just wanted to say also to any of the loved ones out there who are ill, it's really not a luxury for the caregiver to want to take a break and go out for lunch with a friend, go do a hobby, you know, get absorbed in a book. That's really not a luxury. That's something that caregivers need to do to restore themselves. And the extent to which they can build in that activity to restore themselves is really important for maintaining their ability to help you over time. Second, we know in terms of coping with stress that exercise is a powerful way to reduce stress. And many of you out there may have said, oh, I hear that all the time, you know, go exercise, but I don't have time to do that. I'm trying to do a million things, and that would be great, but I don't have time now. And so I can understand that, but again, if you can find some way to even build 10 or 15 minutes into your schedule to get outside, to walk around the block, or maybe go to a mall that's, you know, earlier in the morning where you can get some exercise, I'm not sure what way you will be able to do in your own lifestyle, but try to think about exercise. It reduces stress, and it's one of the most powerful ways that we know now of reducing stress in people who have all kinds of stress. A third point I want to make is that information reduces stress. One of the patients in our study at one point said to me, you know, information is like medicine. In other words, the more that person was able to get information, the more they felt a little bit more in control of their situation. Even though they didn't feel like they could control their illness, they just felt they were a little more in control of their life. And as Dr. Stein said, it's really helpful when loved ones can go to the office visit with the person who is ill to get firsthand information. If you sort of remember that old telephone game, you know, it started with one person, and by the time it got to the last person around the table, it was completely distorted. Well, what we want to do is be sure that the caregiver gets firsthand information so that there isn't any distortion by the time they get the information. And the other reason is caregivers need to be able to ask their own questions, because quite often caregivers' questions are different from the questions that the person who's ill might ask. Fourth, try to surround yourself with positive people. You know, there are people in our lives that are sometimes can be a little bit crabby, or they can quickly pull us down when we weren't feeling down before we met them. And when you're trying to deal with a chronic illness, or you're struggling with your role as a caregiver, that's the time maybe to sort of limit your time with people who are likely to bring you down, and try to surround yourself with people who help you feel better about the care that you're providing and what you're doing for your loved one. Fifth, work as a team. I know Dr. Stein mentioned the importance of a team, the medical team, but the team is also important so that the patient and the caregiver feel like a team. It's they're in it together. They're both affected by it, and the extent to which they say, okay, let's both of us try to go forward and live a quality of life, even though we know we're dealing with this illness, either in you or me or both of us, try to work as a team. That means you support one another, you check things out with one another, and you try to help one another as much as possible. And the last thing I want to say, as caregivers out there, you know, sometimes you wonder if you're doing enough. And I would really encourage you, maybe on a daily basis, to think about what it is that you are doing. What is your strength? What are you contributing to this situation? And remind yourself that even if you feel stressed, you are making an important contribution. So, Dr. Messner, that's what I have right now, and I'll turn it back to you.
Well, that was wonderful, Dr. Northouse. That was just a wonderful presentation and really so important for all our caregivers to hear your really suggestions for them. So thank you. And our next speaker is Carly Mesovitz, and Carly is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. And Ms. Mesovitz is going to address coping with holidays, special occasions, anniversaries, and birthdays. We have holidays coming up soon, long-distance caregiving, and the free psychosocial support services and groups offered by Cancer Care. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Mesovitz.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner. It's really a pleasure to be a part of this call today, and I want to commend all of you who are listening with us today because it really shows that you're taking some time away from your busy lives to really think about your own needs as well as the needs of your loved ones or the patients that you're caring for. So because we're heading into fall and we're really gearing up for the holiday season, that often gets many caregivers thinking about what are the next couple of months going to look like. And so I wanted to take an opportunity to talk with you more about ways of coping with holidays, special occasions, anniversaries, and birthdays. And hopefully some of these tips will be helpful for you to use across all of these different special occasions, which I'll talk about in a little bit. So the holidays and these other special occasions often represent a time of celebration and connecting with loved ones, and coping with cancer and caregiving during this time can really be stressful. Planning for these events can be overwhelming for anyone to begin with, but adding the impact of a loved one's myelofibrosis can be especially taxing, both for the person with cancer and the caregiver. There adds a lot more moving parts and many extra things to factor in to how you want to celebrate. The good news is that there are a lot of things that caregivers can do to help themselves as well as their loved ones to be able to maximize these opportunities and these special occasions. Paying attention to your own physical and emotional needs as well as your loved ones are really important elements that can help make the most of these special occasions. So think about both your needs and your loved ones' needs. You can start by considering what each specific holiday or milestone means to you. What are the most important elements of the celebration? Is it the people, the place, the food, or a certain tradition? Being mindful of the significance of the event can be a helpful starting place in beginning to think about how cancer can fit into the picture rather than the other way around. Planning ahead can also be helpful. Anticipate these occasions before they happen and talk with your loved one about them. Consider what you and your loved one can tolerate this year and give yourself flexibility to create a new tradition or celebrate differently this time around. As I'm sure you've all learned, managing expectations is an important part of coping with a loved one's cancer diagnosis, so consider what traditions you may need to take a pass on or change up this year. Specifically in talking about the holidays, establishing new holiday traditions with close family or friends might allow both the person with cancer and the caregiver to feel more satisfied and also more well-supported during these celebrations. Is your loved one experiencing treatment side effects like fatigue or dietary changes? Think about inviting friends or family over for a potluck so that you can focus on spending time together without all the hard work of cooking and preparing a large meal. You still get the opportunity to really connect with the people who you care about, but without some of the physical challenges of that. Or if you choose to go out to celebrate, communicate things like dietary needs or special requests to the host as a way of managing the expectation of you and your loved one and ensuring that your needs are being met and also ensuring that you have an extra layer of support as you navigate making these kind of plans. And also, for the caregiver especially, give yourself a break. So many caregivers put pressure on themselves to be able to do it all. So recognize your efforts and know that you're doing the very best that you can. And also, don't hesitate to reach out for support of your own by asking for help when you need it. You can enlist the support of friends or family and talk with your loved one's medical team. they might also have additional suggestions, tips, or support to really help you make the most of these events and really be able to focus back on the celebration and the point of them rather than some of the treatment side effects that your loved one might be dealing with. And also, something that I want to talk a little bit more about is that it's important to remember that being a caregiver can mean a lot of different things. You can be a really meaningful and significant part of your loved one's cancer experience, whether you live locally or are caring from a distance. So let's focus on long-distance caregiving for a bit because it affects so many of the population of caregivers out there. Caregivers who are not local to their loved ones can provide significant emotional support, a listening ear, and can really offer a sense of camaraderie and social support for their loved ones. A lot of this can happen by phone, text, email, and Skype. Technology is certainly an advantage, especially nowadays, and can really help you to feel connected and in the loop. Staying in touch helps the patient to feel supported and can help the long-distance caregiver feel like they're contributing and being helpful and productive. It's important to remember that this layer of emotional support is often as helpful, if not more helpful sometimes, than providing physical care. So keep that in mind. Caregivers can also help coordinate medical appointments, get to know the medical team, and advocate for their loved one's needs, both health-related and otherwise, regardless of their physical location. So you can ask your loved one if they're comfortable having you on speakerphone during a medical appointment, or ask if they'd be okay with you sending them a list of questions that you have that they might be able to discuss with their doctors during their next appointment, and then have them report back to you. It's an ongoing discussion that you can have with your loved one about how to navigate this, but communicating your needs and getting access to this really important information can be helpful, again, for you as the caregiver to feel involved, but it also gets your questions answered and reminds the patient or the person with cancer that you're there for them and that you want to be involved in whatever way you can be. A lot of long-distance caregivers often struggle with feelings of guilt and wish that they could do more for their loved one with cancer, and that's a common theme for almost all of the long-distance caregivers that I've worked with. So remind yourself of all that you are doing rather than focusing only on what you can't do or what limitations there are because of your distance. So give yourself credit for all of the efforts that you've made and check in with your loved one to see if they have any other suggestions about how you can continue to be helpful to them. And like Dr. Northouse spoke of earlier, remember to take good care of yourself and be gentle with yourself. Long-distance caregivers really need support too, so reach out to a support group or contact a social worker to help you make meaning out of your caregiver experience and find ways of being there even when you can't be there. And I want to mention also that cancer care does provide a number of different supportive services to caregivers and people experiencing myelofibrosis as well as other cancer diagnoses to help them manage many of the challenges and concerns that this panel of experts described earlier. Cancer care is a staff of licensed master's level oncology social workers, and all of our services are completely free of charge. We're really experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a loved one's diagnosis. Our programs include individual counseling and support groups in the New York City area, as well as over the phone and online. We also offer educational resources like the Connect workshop that you're on right now, and we can provide information about other resources and ways to navigate the healthcare system, as well as practical help and some limited financial assistance. Support groups can be especially helpful for caregivers, as both Dr. Northouse and Dr. Stein mentioned earlier, both to normalize the experience of the caregiver, lessen feelings of isolation, and create a sense of camaraderie and support. And while we here at Cancer Care might not be able to resolve all of the problems that you face every day, a cancer care social worker provides a listening ear and the ability to help counsel you as you navigate your caregiver experience. So many caregivers find this to be a reassuring and comforting service that can help you feel less alone. So to hear more about any of our other services or to connect with a social worker, please call us at our toll-free hotline at 1-800-813-4673 or 1-800-HOPE. Or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our services. thank you so much for letting me talk to you all today. It's been a great pleasure, and I'll pass things back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Messner. That was a wonderful presentation, very informative, and lots of resources now for people to hear. And I'm going to, now we have time for our panel of experts' questions, and I'm going to have Kate bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to ask them questions. And Kate will explain to you how to queue up for questions. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we do not get to your question, please contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE at the end of the call so we can address any questions you didn't get to ask. Kate, can you explain to the audience how to queue up for questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit a question by clicking Ask a Question. And again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question at this time, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone.
And we have a question from one of our online participants. There's a couple of components to that question. The first part is about the flu season approaching. And the caregiver is concerned that not be able to fulfill all of my responsibilities as a caregiver for my mother with myelofibrosis if I catch the flu. So the question is, how can I be prepared? So I'm going to ask Dr. Northhouse if you can describe how one can be prepared if one, as a primary caregiver, is in some way not well, doesn't feel well, and actually needs to have some other plan in place. Dr. Northhouse?
Well, that's a very good question. With the flu season approaching, and it's very important if the caregiver gets the flu shot, if his or her health permits, to try to prevent the chance of getting a flu. You know, good hand washing, trying to eat healthy, and so forth are other preventative measures that caregivers can take. I also think that sometimes caregivers are hesitant to go to their own primary care physician to deal with symptoms that they may have because they just put it off. And I would just say that it's really important for you to go to your own primary care provider if you're not feeling well to try to get things taken care of as soon as you can. If by chance you unfortunately do get the flu, it's really helpful to know who might be around you to step in and help. They, of course, might be afraid of coming in because of the flu, but nevertheless, I'm sure there are people out there that would be willing to come and help. So I would encourage you to try to think about that ahead of time, who you might be able to call on.
And then another part of this question I'm going to ask Dr. Stein, because the flu season is approaching, can you just comment on people with myelofibrosis and their advisability of getting flu shots for people living with myelofibrosis? How is that something that is encouraged, or can you comment on that?
Yes, I would encourage, we do encourage all of our patients with myelofibrosis, other chronic blood diseases, to definitely get vaccinated. So I think it is a good idea. It's something to start thinking about now. Just with myelofibrosis, you know, we all have a chance to get the flu, but with myelofibrosis, you may have a little less reserve to fight off that flu as well as family members or caretakers or friends have. So I would recommend vaccinating. That's a very good question.
Excellent. And then, Carly, do you want to add anything to that plan of how to be prepared?
Absolutely. I want to say that having a backup plan or a team of people who can step in the case of an emergency or an illness can be helpful, not only for the caregiver to feel like they've got all their bases covered, but can help the patient to feel secure and feel like they've got a real team, a real network of people who are on their side, a real community support. So I just wanted to reiterate that point. Whether you're dealing with the flu or not, you know, have an option for who can step in if you can't be there.
And that's excellent. And, you know, there are a number of organizations that are listed, you know, in your resources, and some of them include, of course, Cancer Care, but there also is the MPN Education Foundation and the MPN Research Foundation, which are wonderful resources for you, along with all the other organizations that are mentioned here as well. There are many organizations that could help you to think up a backup plan for yourself to have in general, even if you're feeling well, in addition to the flu, just to have a respite for yourself, some break, actually, from caregiving. So it's really important. And then the next question is, can you recommend any diet, exercise, or vitamins that would help me as an exhausted caregiver? I'm going to ask you, Dr. Northouse, if you could address that in a general way, because, of course, everyone has very different medical needs in terms of recommendations like this. But if you could say just some general guidelines about maybe self-care from a physical perspective. I'm going to also ask Dr. Stein to weigh in on that as well.
Okay.
Dr. Northouse?
Yes, just to make a couple of comments, I agree that each person has a diet that may work better for him or her. But typically healthy eating with the fruits and vegetables, trying not to skip meals because your caregiver has many things to do. We've found at times that caregivers will eat fast food or not eat a full meal if they're trying to rush and do things. And so it's sometimes it's not only what you eat, but that you do eat. So I would say healthy foods and a regular meals. In terms of exercise, was that the other part of the question, Dr. Mesner?
Yes.
I know that's a hard one. As I mentioned, people have varying times and varying locations in which they can get exercise, but you might try to see if there's people around you who might have suggestions. If you, as I mentioned, walking is really helpful, especially as you're getting older in terms of your joints. If there's something, somebody might be in your neighborhood or at your church or synagogue that could just partner with you for a couple times a week to have some enjoyable exercise.
Excellent. And Dr. Stein, do you want to comment in a general way about this is kind of a general question and both for the caregiver and also for the person living with myelofibrosis as well?
In terms of, I think, I agree with all the points so far. I think that it's been really crucial, a healthy diet, healthy living, exercising, doing what you can do, I think, is really critical. And there really are, as long as your exercise is not extreme, there are really no adverse effects from that, as long as you take it slow and gradually build up. And it's really something we try to emphasize for our patients, and it's good for caregivers because exercise is a very good stress relief. It gives you some time to decompress. In terms of vitamins, minerals, supplements, and sometimes we see patients excessively taking over-the-counter supplements, and for the myelofibrosis patient, we like to keep it. It's already a complex illness. There could be, other complex medical problems going on in a long medication list. We try to keep really what's essential. So in many cases, we'll see patients coming in with iron, B12, folate, lots of different vitamins and minerals, and they're not all necessary. So I think it's good to work with your hematologist, oncologist, or for the caregiver, your primary care doctor, just to see what really might be considered essential and to avoid non-essential medications. A daily multivitamin is generally okay for everyone. But to keep it simple, especially for our patients, and only to take the medications that you really need to take.
Excellent comments, and we would encourage all of you to actually work very closely with your treating healthcare team. And as a caregiver, if you don't have a primary care physician or a doctor that is following you for any other health problems you may have, it's really important to kind of identify someone in your healthcare team that you can work with closely around a plan that you would like to develop involving diet and vitamins and exercise so that you're sure that it's all in keeping with what your own healthcare team understands about your personal healthcare needs. That's really important for everyone on the call. And actually, Dr. Stein, do you want to comment on that, just the role of for the caregiver, the role of their, like a primary care doctor or specialty doctor, depending upon their other health problems that they might have?
So I think it's really important for the caregiver for sure, because I think that the point was made earlier, and it's a good one, that with the stress and demands of being a caregiver, you don't want to neglect your own medical conditions. And so you do need that quarterback, that general internist or primary care provider to sort of really oversee. And the same point for the myelofibrosis patient. Sometimes the other medical problems can get neglected, and the care focuses on the interaction between the hematologist and the myelofibrosis patient. But I think it's really also important for the primary caregiver to stay involved, because there could be other medical problems that we want to make sure are not neglected, other concerns that come up that, in fact, the hematologist may not have as much expertise as the primary care doctor would. So, and I think the point I'm making is really about a team, and I should have mentioned that earlier, that part of the myelofibrosis team really not only the hematologist and the myelofibrosis expert, but that general quarterback, someone who you may have a long-standing relationship with, that can oversee and act as we like to call it, the quarterback. I hope that answers the question.
Thank you very much. So we have a question now from actually in terms of what tips can you provide to help manage my time with my personal needs and my caregiving needs? And so Dr. Northouse, could you address that?
Yes, in terms of what can you do to manage your time and your personal needs, is that that's mainly the question?
Yes. Yes.
Well, it's a challenge, I'll say that, and it's probably not going to be one where you have a perfect plan, and the plan you develop is going to work every week. But I really think it's about the idea of trying to be intentional about time for yourself and balancing. Too often we can just get caught up in caregiving, and it may seem like it never ends, or then there's always something else to do. But you just need to plan it in as part of your schedule that you're going to try to do something to maintain your health. And the balance, again, sometimes there are going to be times when you feel overwhelmed, and that's when you try to reach out to other people and try not to do it all yourself, or, as I mentioned before, put on this strong front when, in fact, you really could use help.
Okay. And that's really so important. And Ms. Messovitz, would you like to comment on that as well?
Sure. I think a lot of that balance between time management, managing the caregiver's own needs versus the patient's needs, is thinking about the priorities. You know, take the cancer off the table a little bit and think about what your very basic needs are. Make sure that you're eating healthy, that you're getting enough sleep, that you're incorporating exercise. Start there, but then also make a to-do list and make sure you're putting even just one thing that you're doing for yourself every day so that you're making sure you're still thinking about you and factoring yourself into this so you really focus on self-care intentionally every day.
Excellent. And another question from one of our online participants. I feel like I make many mistakes as my mother's caregiver. I blame myself many times for letting things be overlooked. How can I cope with this blame and prevent making mistakes? Ms. Messovitz, could you address that?
Sure. So I think a lot of caregivers feel so much pressure to always do the right thing. I mentioned that earlier. The truth is that you're human and this is on-the-job training and you're going to make mistakes. But you can also learn from those mistakes. I think it's also important to get support to help you deal with some of that self-blame. Talking to a social worker or talking with another caregiver who's been in a similar situation can help to normalize your experience so that those feelings feel less intense over time. But the truth is we all make mistakes every day, and you're learning as you go, so you give yourself credit for the things that you're doing well and consider what things that might need a little bit of reworking. But at the end of the day, it's important to be gentle with yourself too.
Very, very good. Very good. Kindness, really, really important to oneself. And Dr. Northouse, would you like to comment on that as well?
Well, that's the exact same word I was thinking, Dr. Messner, that you mentioned is kindness. And as Carly mentioned, I think sometimes caregivers have these really high expectations, trying to do everything, but also being the top-notch caregiver. And while you want to be the best caregiver you can, it's not unusual for caregivers to make mistakes, or for all of us, of us on the call as well. And so trying to accept that you're doing the best you can. You're trying to get the information you need to be an informed caregiver, trying to get support so you yourself don't get burned out, and try to stay healthy so you can also continue in your caregiving role. But knowing that there may be times when you wish you had done something a little bit differently, but try to maybe talk with someone about that, but also be accepting of yourself and be kind to yourself.
Excellent. Okay. And now we have a question really regarding the upcoming holiday, someone getting ready already for the stress of caregiving, and what can I do around the holidays? So although we addressed it, someone's really getting concerned. Also, the question is that many of the other family members are not as helpful, and especially during the holidays. And so how can they manage, because they know that often a lot of the burden for the holidays falls upon them? Carly, would you like to address that?
Yeah, I think it can be so hard to not only think about what the caregiver and the patient need or want in this holiday season, but it can be really hard to navigate and consider all the other family members or friends or people who will be involved. And it can be disappointing when others don't step up in the ways that we might want them to. But I think it's important for the caregiver to, A, manage their expectations of the other family members, think about what their role was before cancer, and consider that they might not change that much from that perspective or from that role. I think the other thing that I mentioned earlier was consider what might need to change a little bit this year. Perhaps it's too much to consider all of the other family members, and maybe you'll want to have just an intimate celebration between you and your loved one. And that's something that you have to give yourself permission to do to make those changes. But really talk with the patient or your loved one who's going through this treatments and this diagnosis, and think about what you want this year.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have a question from one of our telephone participants as well. Kate?
We have a question from the line of Arnie B. Your line is open.
Arnie?
Yes. My question is in regard to a concern that I have, probably many caregivers have. Identifying depression seems to be a side effect that comes up a lot with patients. And it's often very difficult for a caregiver to identify it, to know that she's depressed or whatever, and also how to deal with it, what experience you've had, and because it can be very serious.
That's an excellent question, Arnie. Thank you for that question. And I'm going to ask, first of all, ask Dr. Stein when he's seeing patients how that's something that he would handle just as a physician who sees someone who appears to be depressed. And then I'll ask our other speakers to address just the caregiver tips and things. Dr. Stein?
Yeah, excuse me. I think that's a very good point. So the first thing is, often the hematologist or oncologist doesn't have, certainly sees a lot of depression, but may not be the best to manage it. But the questions, the distinction we try to make is whether or not this is depression versus sort of what we call demoralization, because myelofibrosis can have a lot of physical symptoms that can really lead to emotional compromise and demoralization from feeling so poorly and so tired for so long. So we want to try to separate the two. But what we typically do here is we work very well, and we're fortunate to have a supportive care or supportive oncology group that works alongside us, where we can make an easy referral, where a patient can go and visit with both a therapist and a psychiatrist to have a more expert opinion about depression. And then if there's a medication that needs to be started, the psychiatrist can help start, manage, and titrate. But it's also very important to have a therapist as well, because the medication alone is not going to be as helpful as medication plus therapy, talking. So that's typically what we would do. I think it's very helpful, the point I made earlier is, as you brought up, for the caregiver to bring this up to the attention. Some of these visits can be short and it can feel rushed, and that's unfortunate. But again, it's got to be brought to the forefront so that if we otherwise don't know, then there's less likely to be action. But it can be a very serious symptom. So if the caregiver recognizes it and the patient may not be expressing it or may have reluctance to do so, it's important to bring it up at the appointment so that we can take action.
Excellent. And Ms. Nesovitz, do you want to address this as well?
Sure. I think it's really hard to differentiate between sadness and depression, and a caregiver is not necessarily going to be able to see the very the ins and the outs and the differences. So, again, I think seeking support from a professional is going to be the most helpful. So connecting your wife with her hospital social worker, having her contact a social worker at cancer care, can start to help us to assess what's going on. Is it a normal experience sadness is certainly part of the process of being diagnosed with cancer, but we want to make sure that she's got access to the support that she needs if, in fact, it is a deeper depression. And I think it's really great that, Arnie, that you're paying attention to this and realizing that this is a potential outcome. And so supporting her in this and helping her to get support professionally is going to be one of the most helpful things that you can do, both for her and also for yourself.
And then, Arnie, we really appreciate this. It's a wonderful question. I'm going to ask Dr. Northaus to comment as well. But I do want to say that also it's okay for you to get support in dealing with your wife's sadness or your partner's sadness. And that's really important that you get that kind of support as well, both from Cancer Care and any of the other organizations, or the team offering you support, because if you are the one who's having a hard time with it, which it is really hard for the caregiver, we definitely want you to know that you would want to get help sometimes, even before the one you love is willing to get that kind of help. So we know that you're identifying this issue very strongly. And Dr. Northaus, would you like to comment as well?
Well, I agree with all the suggestions the others have made. I think, Arnie, you've done a wonderful job of not minimizing what you're saying. Sometimes people just want to ignore it and say, I don't really want to see this. But it seems to me you're looking at it straight on, and you're recognizing the sadness for what it is. And so I think it's important you take it seriously as you are.
Excellent. Well, this has been an extraordinary call. I want to thank all of you who have asked such wonderful questions, both online and on the telephone. And Arnie, with your concluding question, which is really important as well, I want to thank our speakers who have been extraordinary on the call today and all of you who have been listening. I want to remind you that this is a one-hour program and that in planning a program like this, we know that you have many needs that go beyond the scope of 1 hour. I want to direct all of you after the call to feel free to call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE for support, guidance, anything that we can help you with, or any questions you may have that you didn't get to ask or that come up after the call. As we conclude the call, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone. I want you to know that you're part of this community of support. We're here to help you, and please do call us. Thank you all, and have a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.